My name is Michael McCusker. And I suppose you already know that this coming weekend is Memorial Day, the beginning of the silly season. And it's rather ironic, this latest VA scandal about being unprepared and unfunded or underfunded for the care that they have to take care of people. They claim to be unprepared, but good grief, the same thing in Vietnam. Damn near every U.S. military hospital in the world was stuffed with wounded. And the VA was just overwhelmed by all the people that needed help, you know, their legs blown off from the booby traps and arms and things like that. Plus more wounded lived, and now more wounded even now live more with traumatic brain injuries. My sister reminded me this morning on the phone that the Bushies used to claim that Iraq and Afghanistan would be low casualty wars. So here we are unprepared again. And we have veterans now from at least 4 or 5 wars going back nearly 3/4 of a century. And many of them, millions of them, are still alive, although the World War II guys are dying like vets, guys and women. But I guess we're just going to have to stop being so damn bellicose about sending troops off to wars. Of course, I've noticed that the people most anxious to the first response would be war, you know, sending the troops off are those who've never been themselves. Which, in a way, not going to wars is exactly the topic of my program, which is dedicated to Memorial Day. And what I'm about to read, I have read in one version or another more than once and might well read again in future Memorial Days. But the message is essentially the same. I don't think I will change until I'm under the dirt. I call it Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead, and I start with a quote from The Magus by John Fowles. And his character, Conscious, if you remember him, is saying, I'm quoting him, because these events could have taken place only in a world where a man considers himself superior to women, in what Americans call a man's world, that is, a world governed by brute force, humorless arrogance, illusory prestige, and primeval stupidity. Men love war because it allows them to look serious, because it is the one thing that stops women laughing at them. In it, they can reduce women to the status of objects. That is the great distinction between the sexes. Men see objects, women see the relationships between objects. Whether the objects need each other, love each other, match each other, it is an extra dimension of feeling that we men are without, and one that makes war abhorrent to all real women. And absurd. I will tell you what war is. War is a psychosis caused by an inability to see relationships, our relationship with our fellow men, our relationship with our economic and historical situation, and above all, our relationship to nothingness, to death. And that was from The Magus by John Fowles. Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. And I guess I should probably give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion in all of the cosmos and multiple universes, but I don't think so. Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. The most shamelessly exploited minority in American society is its war dead. They died horribly, and most of them unwillingly, but they are not left to rot in peace. Their molding, mutilated corpses are eloquently exhumed as spearheads for the next war, their deaths extolled to recruit new armies. A language of lies develops. The dead always died for their country, heroically and nobly, and all of them willingly made the publicly acclaimed final sacrifice. None raped, pillaged, or burned, or committed other than sanctioned murder or terrorism. None died because of simple bad luck, or from their own stupidity, or that of their commanders, or from callous or asinine battle strategies. None died from accidental shelling or bombing by their own side, known as friendly fire. All of them were killed facing the enemy, not running away. Their deaths are glorified as justifications for the wars that killed them. Nations are haunted by their war dead. Monuments and memorials are built in every city and somewhere near the city center of every town. The war dead assume a purity in death most would have found difficult to attain in life. The official piety is that the cultural lifeblood is sustained by their deaths rather than drained, and only by sacrificing themselves in the same manner will the living gain a similar historical legitimacy. Service to the state is always a possibility to the young, and death in its service is presented as either an ideal or an unavoidable necessity. Families of the dead who should protest the slaughter of their young are instead used as willing accomplices in the demand that warfare is the only acceptable response to an unruly world. Those who resist that specious reasoning are compared to the heroic dead as unworthy cowards and traitors, implicitly responsible for their deaths. "War would end if the dead could return," Stanley Baldwin said. But the irony of war deaths, exploited as coercion for others to murder and die, is lost in the thunder of voices calling for vengeance and righteous war. War survivors are used as shabbily as the dead. They are contained within government-sponsored veterans organizations that rubber-stamp their approval on everything military. They are given parades and empty honors. The horror of their war experiences is shielded from public view, gold-plated in boilerplate and pageantry. Yet they are undeniably representatives of humanity's dark side that civilization attempts to disregard or abstract, even while perpetuating it through them. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact we often ignore it in our preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, weapons, and machines of war. Each generation seems to think it should not be outdone by its predecessors. It must leave its bloody mark on history, no matter how absurd or pointless. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the pattern of terror and suffering each inflicts on itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that our era, which is noteworthy only because we live in it, be no less dramatic than the histories we imitate. Albert Schweitzer warned in 1924 that the suicide of civilization was in progress because humanity has lost, quote, the consciousness that every man is an object of concern because he is man, and that's in upper case. And he predicted that the advance of fully developed inhumanity was only a matter of time. We have talked for decades with ever-increasing light-mindedness about war and conquest, as if these were merely operations on a chessboard, Schweitzer wrote, asking how else that might be possible then, as a result of a tone of mind which no longer pictured to itself the fate of individuals, but thought of them only as figures or objects belonging to the material world. Half a century later, philosopher Donald Wells offered another explanation. The problem of war and conquest and the diminished value of human life was not due to a vague tone of mind, but the demand of government authority over the masses. Wells wrote, "If it is presumed at the outset that the life of the state transcends that of the individual in value, indeed that the state is more important than all the citizens, then the fact of human death, on even a cosmic scale, will prove irrelevant as an argument against war." Inhumanity is exclusively human. History seldom mentions compassion or the consciousness of every human being as an object of concern, as Schweitzer said, as vital ingredients to the structure of civilization. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fear and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only their numbers are marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human, and by extension other cultures, nations, religions, and races, as our blood enemies. We continue to war, or think of war, as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. We refuse to think of ourselves as part of the same macro family or to understand the rarity or privilege of life. Instead, we make war more ardently than love. War gives our lives a transcendent vitality the daily living and its squalid defeats squeeze out of us. We feel that we are a vital part of great events, that our normally diminished lives serve an important purpose at a watershed moment, and we are never so unified, so able to collectively surmount tremendous obstacles as when we make war against each other. We make excuses for warfare and accept it as a consequence of living. We seldom think of war as our invention. We treat it instead as a natural phenomenon, an earthquake, a flood, or volcano. We feed its insatiable thirst for blood with the best blood stock we produce. Until recently, the highest honors a nation or people could bestow were upon the men who draped themselves in the blood of others. Life's heroes have always been the men of death. As with most other effects of rapacious technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war any time, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapons systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in wars made possible by outlandish weapons designed in the manner of video games is verification of the popularity of reality as image devoid of involvement. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which has been almost too large a horror to bear for nearly three quarters of a century. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most folks refuse to think we could be so foolish, yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fears, urged instead to the possibility of the unthinkable by prospects of opportunity. In such a world, reality hurts. We turn away as we would from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to mute our angst. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of instant birth, it is a prophecy of megadeath. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's reckless ferocity that leads irresistibly toward plucking the ripe fruit of spicicide. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing and fornicating. We are a killing species. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creature. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. We have throughout history honored the killers among us, and as we have become more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations unlucky to be along the march of more militant, ambitious societies. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffer firsthand is given little consideration. War has determined the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their private horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, although collectively these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of historical occurrence. The ambiguity of history might be encompassed in a phrase used often by Oliver Cromwell and others, "Pray for peace, prepare for war." Earth bristles with preparation. Yet a grim irony of this dark era is that we have reduced human participation in warfare, with an exception possibly of dying in appalling numbers. The invention of the harpoon gun and the exploding harpoon decimated the whales. The chainsaw has cut down the world's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and hydrogen bomb, we nearly match our reckless despoilation of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. We have perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification. No philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. Although armies might seem superfluous, they are useful for performing traditional fratricide, short of provoking megadeath. Dead soldiers are Christ-like in a sense. They die as surrogates for the rest of us. Unrestricted warfare in the last century significantly enlarged soldiers' always shadowy and disavowed parallel role as surrogate executioners. Looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet war shapes nations and individuals. Much of what each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate war is so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He did not foresee its possibilities as video entertainment. Aptly named Predator robot drones targeting small villages, also so-called smart missiles breaking down doors and falling through industrial chimneys. High-tech stuff in which sky warriors or computer pilots half a world away, anonymously and indiscriminately, always hotly denied, murder strangers from the stratosphere. Most significant to the human psyche is that a century of air warfare has made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to existence. A people will generally support a war once it is initiated, if for no other reason than they feel there is not much else they can do. That support is considered essential for conducting a war to its end in victory or defeat. In this era of the supposed common person, the focus of support is upon the average soldier, sailor, and airman or woman, who are not responsible for the wars they fight in but make possible. Bellicose war fever is whipped up to discourage questions of a war's purpose or cost and to disguise the contradiction that supporting a soldier's warlike duty is a sure way of killing him or her. "There is no good war and no bad peace," Benjamin Franklin said. But peace is also distinguished as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder to continue the genocides of their fathers. The questions of how to end warfare are ancient, but never as popular as promoting it. The very few who raise the issue of abolishing war have been imprisoned, exiled, or executed through the centuries. At the very least, they are ostracized. Pacifism exudes an odor of weakness and appeasement, and pacifists are accused of being agents or dupes of an enemy. Pacifists are themselves in conflict. The central, most agonizing question is whether some principles are worth the risk of annihilation. Human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss is a result of dispute over abstract principles peculiar to a point in time would be more intolerable than the loss of those principles, which, human in origin, would just as surely evaporate in a Holocaust. "What difference does it make to the dead," Gandhi asked, "whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty and democracy?" Solutions to warfare have been ambiguous, insipid, and often ridiculous. Most pacifists agree that the only end to warfare will be a world state of some sort, but one world theories range from a loose federation of states not unlike the United Nations, with the exception that its laws would be binding, to naked utopias and otherworldly Edens, or more ominously, Orwellian or Huxleyan nightmares of rigid authority and mind control, as well as perpetual war. Most solutions acknowledge the necessity of alternatives to warfare to engage its immense energies. William James suggested in 1914, the year World War I began, a century ago this year, that there ought to be a moral equivalent to warfare. And although his idea that society exhibit the pomp and circumstance of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta was rather silly, but not out of context with his pompous era, he also thought that, quote, so long as the anti-militarists propose no substitute, no moral equivalent to war, the duties, penalties, and sanctions pictured in the utopias they paint are all too weak and tame to touch the military-minded. That is exactly the point. Militarism rules the planet. Military values are taught at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are poured into war machines that posture as defensive instruments, and world leaders blackmail their populations with terror, force them to surrender their lives and their children's futures, their wealth and liberties if they possess either, to the gross appetites and deadly illusions of military power. Nightmares of doom are disguised as dream worlds of prosperity. Armageddon is the final place for the last battle at the end of the world. Almost all religions and myths prophesize a final conflict or cataclysm that will terminate human life, and our history has propelled us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. Military castes have been as irresponsible as priests in exhorting doom. They speak of themselves as guardians of peace, but prepare the methods for final combat, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. War is to a man what childbirth is to a woman, Benito Mussolini was fond of saying. Putting an end to warfare will not end human conflict or greed, but war should be put aside as a toy of our youth. The ancient assumption that war weeds out the weak, unfit, and unlucky to ensure strength in future generations has been disproved by the enormous and indiscriminately devastating wars of the 20th century. A general who commanded the largest armies in history and who was president of the United States warned the world of the sinister and possibly obliterative consequences of the military-industrial mafia. His original inclusion of Congress was dropped. Dwight Eisenhower once said that people want peace so much that one of these days government had better get out of the way and give it to them. History's dark glare shines on an earth too fragile for the titanic clashes of its past. Humanity, however, responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than to peace for its own sake, and never are these traits more represented than through a war's victors arguing over spoils of a defeated enemy. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilizations' expanse and technologies. Yet war has also turned out the lights of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its predilection for war. Long periods of decline and retrogression, generations denied opportunities of learning and rebuilding, interminable cycles of darkness. Human antipathy does not go away easily or for very long. Old hatreds scab over only briefly and soon re-erupt. Someone somewhere covets something possessed by a neighbor, land, wealth, power. An insurgency plans an assault or ambush. Terrorists target innocents and guilty deliberately. A newly established nuclear power readies to flex it on an old enemy. Big war stuff trickles down from defunct Cold War arsenals into the grabby little hands of schoolchildren who arm themselves in the manner of gunfighters or gangsters. Peace-loving peoples commit genocide upon rivals. Large parts of the world act as laundries for ethnic or pious cleansing. Countries or persons publicly declare themselves as pacifist yet act as vicious as attack dogs. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it for millions who are slaughtered by fellow humans for reasons peripheral and perishable. The United States commemorates its war dead on Memorial Day, which is at the end of May. It would be the proper occasion to pierce the illusions and deceptions and remember that the hallowed dead would bitterly protest being used to kill others, and to take note of something written by Boris Vann. The day nobody comes back from a war, it will be because war has at last been properly organized. The monument to the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C. is what a war memorial should be, a measure of its cost. The wall of names of Americans killed in Vietnam is a tribute to them from those who fought beside them and survived. A second wall should be set alongside, containing the names of all Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers who died in the war, and both walls surrounded by a wall listing the names of every Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Laotian, man, woman, and child who were not combatants, but were killed because they were in the water the killer fish swam in, to paraphrase Mao's famous metaphor that the people were the sea to be fought over. Perhaps a special monument might be erected with the names of the murdered dead of My Lai by Americans and Wei by North Vietnamese, or Fallujah and Haditha in Iraq, to serve as a warning that the only enemy is the malevolence we humans feel toward each other. "With them in hell," wrote Wilfred Owen, regarded the best poet of World War I and perhaps the best war poet ever, killed a week before the armistice in 1918. "The sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." And that was something I wrote and have rewritten many times. And I've read it on the air in all its different guises over these years. And I suppose if I live long enough, I will continue to do so, at least at this time of year. And about this time of year, I'd like to read something that I also wrote, so my disclaimer still stands. And this is actually from a letter I wrote to the Daily Astorian 12 years ago. I call it Insipid Hollow Days. "I am a veteran of the Vietnam War. I spent most of a year, 1966-67, as a USMC combat correspondent with infantry and reconnaissance up around the DMZ and south to My Lai, which we roared through a year earlier than Callie's platoon. The war is never far from my thoughts, essentially an underlying music scored for horror movies, which I expect to last until I finish up on the other side of the dirt with my war mates who did not survive Vietnam or died later from wounds, drugs, suicide, or just plain numbed inertia. Well-meaning friends insist I forget about the war, but that is as impossible as it is dishonest to deny war's insights into the real human character we generally camouflage to protect ourselves from self-knowledge. I think that is a major reason I seriously object to the manner in which we in the United States commemorate Memorial Day, and for that matter, the equally empty celebration of Labor Day. Unions don't march anymore. Each seems to be little more than a bookend holiday weekend beginning and ending the annual silly season. Memorial Day was first established as a single day of national mourning for its war dead, with the powerful element of jingoism inherent, inspired by the Civil War in which everyone killed on either side or caught in between was an American, including slaves. The questions of just and unjust wars are momentarily transcended by annual recognition of their grim costs. Now that we are at war again, which might prove to be pyrrhic as well as perpetual, it is essential that all of us are truly aware of what we are countenancing. I think Memorial Day should return to a single day, May 30th, as it was traditionally, and be regarded in its original intent or discarded entirely. The present three-day holiday makes a mockery of commemoration of the nation's war dead, and public ceremonies appear tawdry and comically manipulative. If we are to honor Memorial Day, we should do it for real. The same with Labor Day, or abolish both in acknowledgement that they have been trivialized to little more than facades for commercially sponsored partying. Chambers of Commerce will yowl at any such return to basics, of course, and regard it as obviously anti-business as well as palpably unpatriotic. Perhaps public celebrations are meant to go only skin deep, as insipid, officially sanctioned observances of things that profoundly affect us individually and as a nation, so as to ease the itch of nagging, deeper reflections that might be dangerous. And that was what I call insipid, hollow days. And now I'd like to read a poem by Margaret Leah Bowler. After War. Here, over blood-stained, craggy soil, the tattered banner waves, high above the final battlegrounds, where hundreds slaughtered lie in eternal sleep, their blood tinting the dirt. The banner flies, held up by the wind, witness to desolation, until time itself tears the fabric remnants from the pole, and everything crumbles to dust. And that was After War by Margaret Leah Bowler. And Margaret was 11 when she wrote this poem. And I printed it in the July issue of the 2001 North Coast Times Eagle, which I published a long time ago now, it seems. And as Dalton Trumbo said, if the dead mean nothing to us except on Memorial Day weekend when the national freeway is clotted with surfers, swimmers, skiers, picnickers, campers, hunters, fishers, footballers, beer busters. What of our wounded? Does anyone know where they are, how they feel, how many arms, legs, ears, noses, mouths, faces, penises they've lost? How many are deaf and dumb or blind or all three? How many are single or double or triple or quadruple amputees? How many will hang on as defibrillated vegetables, quietly breathing their lives away in small, dark, secret rooms? And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Memorial Day, which I guess is officially this Monday, but used to be on May 30th, whichever day that falls on this year.